Ahoy, Vachon. How's the French say, Vachon? This is the Brown Briefly, where less is more, more or less, coming to you live over KVSH 101.9 FM, Voice of Vachon, your island connection. Please make us part of your day. And be advised that our assertions and views, which can modestly be described as progressive persuasion, do not in any way reflect the opinions of KVSH or Voice of Vachon.
Welcome to the Brown Briefly podcast and weekly radio show on the Voice of Vachon, located on beautiful Vachon Island in the heart of the Salish Sea between Seattle and Tacoma in the state of Washington. That was the voice of Brian Brown, creator of the Brown Briefly. Brian started the Briefly and brought his high standards of intelligent discussion of current events, laced with humor and empathy. Brian's motto was, more is less, or less is more, more or less.
How many times have you given that?
Not enough, obviously.
Oh, that's funny.
But Brian always offered so, so much more. Our Briefly panel includes our big board pilot, real-life pilot, treetop flyer, and almost fully reformed West Texan. Notice I put West in there.
Thank you.
Truman O'Brien.
Thank you very much. Yes, I'm here behind the big red switch.
It's a big difference between East Texas West Texas.
There is such a difference. You cannot believe. I mean, it's like two different countries, man. Yeah, it really is. Yeah.
Well, and Texas is a different country. Also, Legal Eagle, consensus builder, former Washington State Assistant Attorney General, ladies' shoe salesman, and Fulbright scholar, Craig Bellis.
Great to be here, Bruce. Thank you.
What can we add?
Oh, as you know, we can add a bunch of short-term jobs.
We also have our avid defender of justice, our mariner, cyclist, now a rower, and a former top secret engineer, Kevin Jones, who is joining us by Zoom today. So welcome, Kevin.
Oh, we can't hear. Oh, you know what? I guess it helps if I...
Truman, my fault.
I had you turned off there.
He pushed the big red button.
And now we can hear you.
All right. Well, hey, glad to be here through the power of electronics and Zoom, and hopefully you can hear me fine throughout the day.
Yeah, we can now. Sorry.
Also, one of the Brieflies, but missing today, is our part-time Politico, most-time housing wonk, executive director of Vachon Household, and our full-time shenanigans coordinator, Amy Dreyer. So, Amy, we'll miss you. We need more shenanigans planned here.
We actually have some shenanigans we need to rehearse for.
Oh, well, that's true.
For the Voice of Vachon coming up here in a few weeks.
Yes. Is it that close?
It is.
Oh, my gosh.
It is rolling right up on us.
Maybe tell folks a little bit about that.
Correct? Well, it's a fundraiser for the Voice of Vachon, and I don't have the date off the top of my head.
I believe it's the 12th.
12th or 13th. Doggone it all.
Oh, geez.
But it's at VCA.
It gives us 2 weeks.
Yeah, I know. I need 2 weeks to figure out what the date and the location are. So I will get that in a moment.
Okay. A public announcement coming up later in the show, right?
Right.
And then I'm historian Bruce Holman, and we have as our small talk guest today, cartographer Stefan Freeland. Welcome, Stefan.
Thank you. Good morning.
It's good to have you here. So, as usual, before we jump into the show, let's take a moment and check in about what special things we've experienced this past week. So, Truman, what's up with you?
Well, first of all, it's Friday, October 17th is the voice. So,
it gives us a few more days.
We got a little bit of time to prep. So, and we're not worried about it. Yeah, are we?
what me worry?
Yeah, exactly. I had a pretty exciting time this week. On Saturday, MJ Witt, who's our manager of our CERT program here on Vachon, he and I flew up to Port Angeles. And we attended and observed an exercise that their local disaster airlift response team put on in conjunction with the CERT program from SQUIM. And it was really fascinating to see how they put this all together. They moved 1,300 pounds of food, actually, which was being donated to the food bank in SQUIM. But they moved that 1,300 pounds in just about an hour and a half, 2 hours. They had several small airplanes, which was really a surprise, and two slightly larger airplanes. But MJ got a chance to fly on over to one of the little airports there in SQUIM and meet with the CERT people there. And so we got some real good ideas about some things that we need to do to put our CERT program, I mean, not our CERT, our DART program together on Vashon. But anyway, very fascinating time.
Oh, good. Yeah, it'll be really nice to have that air wing, the Vashon air wing.
Air wing, there we go.
You've got the air wing, and then we've got the sea,
sea wing.
Wave, or whatever.
Right. Yeah, yeah.
The Marine MERT. Emergency Response
Team,
too. Yeah, so that's always good. So, Craig, how about you?
I had a great week, an absolutely great week. Last week, I talked about how our son came up and visited, and I took him all around the historic spots that, Bruce, you were instrumental probably in recognizing and putting up signs and whatnot. We did this again this last weekend with our daughter Kate and her boyfriend Ryan. They were up and just had a fabulous... We did the Docton walking tour, and they were blown away by the museum, the Vashon Museum, once again. Absolutely loved it. And we went to the Coop on Friday. The Coop had the Canadian singer-songwriters, and what a show that Steve Amston, put together for his theme night. It was one of the best I have ever seen. I resisted the temptation to join in on stage that time because my daughter was going to be there, and I didn't want to embarrass her. But then we went to a party at MJ Witt's house. Yeah. Truman was there and brought Kate and Ryan, and they had a wonderful time. They felt really welcomed by a lot of our fellow Vashonites. By the way, MJ Witt's going to be my co-host with Mike Nichols on the Thursday Morning Scramble this week from 9 until noon. We're going to be doing Rockabilly.
Oh.
Right here on KVSH 101.9 FM, LP. The other thing, just the last thing, is last night, Lynette and I, my wife and I, saw the movie The Roses.
Oh.
Now, you probably, a lot of you remember The War of the Roses, right. You're the book, and then the movie with Michael Douglas. Mm-hmm. This one was with Cumberbatch and Olivia Colman and Kate McKinnon from Saturday Night Live. Holy cow. I mean, it was...
I can't wait to see that.
It was so fun, although last night was the last night here.
No.
Are you sure? I think it was.
No. Oh,
well,
I have to check.
I think it was.
Oh, I hope not.
Well, it'll be around. It'll probably be on Netflix here in a week. And that was a kick, a true kick. So that was my week, amongst other things. Good week.
Sounds like a great week. So, Stefan, what have you been up to?
I've been breathing a sigh of relief. You know, rain. Rain is a wonderful thing.
Finally.
And you know, the fall and catching our breath and the joy of puttering. I haven't done enough puttering this summer, and so actually got a few things off the checklist and feeling pretty good about it.
Wow.
Well, and you just moved your mother from Iowa to
the Northwest. Yeah, early this summer. That's part of why I haven't been puttering myself all summer. But yeah, my mother is a recent addition to the Northwest, and that's going very well. So,
oh, great.
Yeah.
Fantastic. Kevin, how about you? What's been up?
You know, Stephen, speaking of rain, yesterday we turned off our irrigation systems here, so we're going to rely on the natural systems to keep the trees green and healthy and all that stuff. But let's see, I did some door knocking over in the 26th Legislative District for Deb Kay, who's going to be one of those really hard to retain progressive seats in our state Senate. So we're looking forward to Deb prevailing. Also did some rowing in Everett. Up the slough around Otter Island. So several of us from Vashon, 12, we had an eight and a quad and did the row. And it was enjoyable to see 200 or so folks showing up for that fundraiser for the Everett Rowing Club. And so that was a great time. One thing we should mention tonight, Bruce, you are going to help kick off Dr. Larry Hubbell's talk about John Lewis, a political hero. It's at the Vashon High School Theater. Starts at 7 o'clock. Doors open at 6:30. And Dr. Hubbell was actually on John Lewis's staff, so we're going to hear from one of the insiders about John Lewis and his legacy of civic change and engagement tonight at 7 o'clock at the Vashon Theater. Hope you can all show up. And Bruce is going to help kind of kick that off for us.
Yeah, it should be fun. It's going to be more of an informal conversation with Larry before he begins his talk, but just getting a little bit about him. And also, he's an interesting guy. He did his dissertation on public sector heroes. A political scientist, did his PhD at Virginia Tech. And so he's chosen four different sort of what he would call public sector heroes he's going to talk about. So it'll be a very, very fascinating series of talks. And tonight kicks it off. So looking forward to it.
And we should just say it is free. We do ask for those who are able, if you can donate to the cause, that would be awesome. And but yeah, look forward to seeing folks there tonight.
Great. My week, I have been moving bricks, which is always an interesting sort of thing to think about. I mean, it's one of those sort of mindless tasks that you do, but it has a regularity to it. And bricks are heavy. It's sort of like, oh, man, I'm getting a workout here that I wasn't expecting. But also it was an exciting football weekend. Mm-hmm. I mean, it started on Thursday with the Seahawks pulling it out in the last second with a field goal, which was just sort of like, I mean, they had dominated the game, and then they sort of like let it slip away into a tie, and then thank goodness it came through with a field goal in literally the last seconds, last 3 seconds of the game to win. And then UW played Ohio State, which was really an interesting game because the first half, you know, UW just shut them down. It was really, and Ohio State ultimately sort of just began to overwhelm UW.
Bruce, that's the Ohio State.
Well,
that's
if right. You're from Ohio,
yes.
For the rest of it, it's just that OS over there. But then the exciting game was University of Oregon and Penn State. And
oh, I mean, baby, that was something, wasn't it?
It was a great game. Yeah. And I mean, went into overtime, and Oregon got the ball first and scored in one play, basically. And then Penn State got the ball, and you expect it because they'd been moving the ball all game long. And bam, first play was an interception, game over. Boom.
Just like that.
Yeah,
wow.
It was a fantastic sort of game. And then, of course, watching the Mariners sort of finish the season on a kind of on an upper, but also they couldn't beat the Angels. So it's just sort of like, it's going to be an interesting postseason.
Yeah, I kind of think there was a pressure was off.
Yeah, know? Right. Yeah, yeah. And they've got a bye here for almost a week.
Yeah.
So now we have to add HOD carrier to your
resume.
I wish I had a HOD.
I'm putting HOD carrier on there the next
That's
time.
Right. Okay. Definitely that. And then also Sunday, our grandson Theodore had one of his first soccer games. Mm. He's playing, he's in second grade, so he's playing with, first and second graders. And it's one of those great sort of soccer matches where the whole group moves together. it's not, I mean, you look across the fields at the, third and fourth, it's fifth, sixth, seventh graders playing, and it looks more like a Sounders game. They're spread out, they're playing positions. This is sort of like the herd moves wherever the ball is,
right?
And they're just flailing away at it, kicking each other in the shins, but it's just a great kind of experience.
We called that bumblebee soccer.
Yeah,
definitely.
That's an appropriate
name. The hive is together, man. It's definitely. So, but a good week. And, of course, it's that bittersweet time of year. You know, it's sort of like we get days like today where it's just gorgeous. Yesterday it just rained all and cloudy all day. And it's just sort of that sense of you're giving up summer but also welcoming the change.
One thing from an aviator's standpoint, the air tends to be a lot more stable in the fall. Hmm. And so it's a lot smoother.
Interesting.
In the spring, it gets to be real bumpy. You know, because the air's a bit agitated. So it's always nice. Our flight up to Port Angeles was beautiful.
Just a few more clouds, though, oftentimes.
Well, that's
more
true.
IMC up there.
That is true. Yeah.
So what is the winter like when there's 80 mile an hour winds up there?
A little more exciting. You know, I took off from SeaTac on the inauguration day storm. Do you remember? Mm-hmm. I don't remember the year now. What was it?
97, 98.
Yeah, something like that. And we took off, and we were at 10,000 feet over the top of Vashon. The wind was blowing 100 knots at 10,000 feet.
Wow.
Yeah. That was a sad day, though. My cousin's horse was killed by a falling tree.
Ooh.
In that storm.
Wow.
Yeah. Pretty wild.
Wow. So we're moving into fall. So today is September 30th. Significant day, as is every day. It's International Podcast Day.
Hmm.
Very appropriate for us. And it's also Orange Shirt Day, which recognizes that it's particularly a day in Canada, but also through the United States growing in importance. But a day to recognize Native American or First Nation children who were forcibly removed from their families and placed into boarding schools. Yeah. So put your orange shirt on, grab your purple a neckerchief, and you'll be colorful today, right?
There you go.
It's the 273rd day of the year, 92 days until New Year's, 86 days until Christmas, 58 days until Thanksgiving, and only 31 days until Craig's favorite holiday of the year.
I do love Halloween in downtown Vashon or uptown Vashon.
It's always a kick. Mm-hmm. Today in history, 1521, Suleiman the Magnificent was proclaimed Sultan of the Ottoman Empire.
I like that moniker, Bruce the Magnificent.
Craig the Omniscient. we could go on.
Craig the Deficient, is that what you said?
Yeah. But Suleiman had a huge impact. On the world at the time. And that's the 1500s. It's hard to remember that long ago. It's sort of like, wow. Yeah, so. And in 1935, Hoover Dam was dedicated.
Was it dedicated as Hoover Dam?
I don't know. So.
Or was that's it dedicated as Boulder Dam?
Yeah. Ah. And renamed.
Yeah. And then renamed.
Yeah. And it wasn't named after J. Edgar.
No. That's interesting. So it was originally Boulder.
Oh, golly, did I stump the historian?
Always. Hey, just walk down the street and I've got stumped. also in 1938, this is when the Munich Agreement was signed and sort of brought supposedly peace in our time, which of course never happened. And in 1954, the USS Nautilus, the first nuclear submarine, was commissioned. So moving on into our small talk session with Stefan Freeland. Stefan, tell us a bit about yourself. Tell us about how you came to be who you are and how you got to Vashon.
In 30 minutes or less?
Yeah, right. Yes, right.
Well, I think
time's up.
In the context of this conversation, I think I'm a cartographer. Mm-hmm. I'm a GIS guy. So GIS is Geographic Information Systems, which is usually considered the digital realm, the electronic computer version of geography and spatial analysis and mapping. Though not just mapping, so I guess in some sense a map is a GIS. A map is a database of spatial information, and when you can in an analog sense, a map is a GIS. But the computerized version of that is moving into the digital. that's where I've spent a lot of my time over the last three decades. I've spent, I was up at the Western Washington University where I taught cartography and GIS and GPS. And now I'm mostly retired and able to spend a fair amount of my time on Vashon. Bellingham has been my home by and large for the last 30, 40 years. I grew up partly in Bellingham. I learned to sail on the Salish Sea and have sort of called the shores home ever since. My connection to Vashon is through my sweetie, Michelle Bates, local photographer. And so started coming down probably a decade ago and more consistently over the last couple of years as my tenure at Western ended. And so now kind of splitting my time half and half. And one of the things I like to do is make maps. And so I've been trying to make maps of Vashon. Gets me my foot in the door, kind of know my way around and exploring it, somewhat digitally, somewhat in person as well. So, yeah. So I'm enjoying being here.
Good. So, tell us a little bit about sailing on the Salish Sea. My recollection is you started on a Thunderbird.
Yeah, pretty much. I mean, we had the family had even smaller. The Thunderbird's relatively small sailboat, an odd kind of DIY fiberglass over plywood, which it has its issues. That was my formative years and sailing and sanding.
Yeah,
fiberglass delaminated.
Yeah.
Yeah. But went through a series of boats as well. I'm actually keel free now. I've severed. I'm down to simply a aluminum Grumman canoe.
All right.
Much lower maintenance.
And you don't have withdrawal symptoms?
There was some, yeah. It was hard to, when the last one left, you know, sold the last keel. But anyway, yeah, it's somewhat of an accomplishment to be.
Now you can actually portage from into Quartermaster Harbor.
That's right.
Yeah,
that's
exactly.
Right.
Yeah. Exactly. So before I ask a question, I need to ask you this. Do you know what a kelchplotter is?
Kelchplotter.
Yeah, no, kelchplotter.
Oh, no,
K-E-L-S-H, plotter.
No, tell
is that
me.
Like a lutefish?
Yeah, similar. No, the reason I want to tell this story is because my brother dealt with photography and mapping and all of those sorts of things in the military. And when he got out, he was in Helena, Montana, and he read an ad for a cartographer. And when he applied for the job, he said, I could do that. When he applied for the job, the interviewer said, well, do you know how to use a kelchplotter? And my brother had no idea what a kelchplotter was, but he said, well, I can use a Weemsplotter. Well, a Weemsplotter is a little piece of plastic that you use in flying. You know, you put your course. I mean, it's just a little plastic thing. And the guy interviewing didn't know what a Weemsplotter was, so he said, well, I guess that's close enough. So they hired him. Well, a kelchplotter is this huge machine that takes stereo pairs of photographs, and they make contour maps using those stereo pairs. And when he arrived, they had two of these machines, and luckily there was another operator there that ran the other one. And the guy thought it was hilarious that he got hired, so he trained him, and he began making maps using this kelchplotter. So the question for you is, tell us about being a cartographer. What is that? What do you do?
Yeah, not very many job openings for cartographers these days.
Yeah, sure.
We're making more maps than ever, but the job, the career of cartographer is pretty rare, it seems like. So making maps, cartographer, my training was in GIS, Geographic Information Systems, and that is usually what that means if you get a job as a GIS guy, is data editing and data maintenance and data management. As you move up the ladder, you get to do spatial analysis and relatively little cartography, which was my love of GIS. So teaching cartography is way more fun than teaching data entry. And doing cartography is way more fun than doing data entry or even spatial analysis. So I've tried to steer myself that direction when I can. The world, you know, digital world, you know, there's tons of maps being made. There's more maps, you know, I don't know how they know this, but they tell us that that over 50% of the maps that humanity has ever been produced have been made during our lifetime.
Wow.
You know, most of those are digital maps, and they're super easy to generate. They were pretty labor intensive back in the day. So there's more maps being made than ever. But you know, a sort of the standard, I mean, there's certain, you know, they're good maps, a lot of good maps out there, but the art form of taking it to the next level of making a cartographic product is somewhat of a rarity. And so when I was teaching cartography, I was trying to at least push, nudge the bar a little bit of sending our students out when they graduate with at least some of the basics of cartographic standards, and try to make those mass-produced maps that we're seeing all over the place, make them a little bit better at least. So that was my goal.
For us sort of novices, if you will, I mean, most of us are familiar with maps and GIS because of our phones,
yeah.
You know, finding a location or you know, or sort of GIS systems in
directions
our cars,
to some,
you know,
place,
you know, getting directions to some place, that kind of stuff. So what's the process of getting there? I mean, I grew up at a time where you had paper maps.
Sure,
right?
Yeah.
So, I mean, what's that transition? How's that taken place?
Well, at this point, I mean, a lot of that, we're in a data-rich time. So it's a great time to become a GIS analyst cartographer, in that we're not having to use the Kelsch plotter as much.
Exactly.
There was a huge, you know, era of digitizing, you know, basically tracing by hand old paper maps. When I came into the field, and I remember one of my mentors saying, "Don't get good at this, because you don't want a career digitizing
no,
old maps."
No.
But at this point, there's just this wealth of data from, you know, every county, every tribe, every, you know, small cities and states. So there's the data is much more readily available for the sort of base stuff. And so it's often gathering that data and then cleaning it up and getting it into the format you want. There's still plenty of data collection and, you know, crunching existing, whether it's GPS or survey or that kind of stuff. But increasingly, it's a matter of harvesting data, as opposed to, you know, people, when I tell people I was a geographer or a cartographer, they're like, "Oh, you're out there," and it's like, no, I don't actually go out. I never live. I'm pretty much in the basement.
Tell us a little bit. I mean, GIS is based mostly on data that's been input, but also on satellites. I mean, the two work together.
There's a bunch of co-minglings there of you know, geospatial technologies. So you've got GPS, which is satellite-based, but allows us to know where you are, but also to collect data on the ground. There's satellite-derived imagery, and then increasingly sophisticated automated methods of taking that image and making it into something intelligent. And then there's just all the data that we think about for, you know, there's a layer of roads and a layer of streams and a layer of, you know, whatever it is, zoning and school districts. So there's all these different agencies, mostly governmental, but a lot of nonprofits and a lot of private as well, creating data and largely sharing that data, that can be then repurposed. So
I remember in college, I was short some credits the one quarter. And so I looked through the catalog and I found geography, and I thought, "Oh, I'll take that. That should be fun. You know, that'd be easy. You know, just looking at maps." Boy, was I surprised! What a killer course that was. We talked about everything.
Yeah.
I mean, socioeconomic, you name it, mining. I mean, everything.
Yeah, was, it's all.
Yeah, it was all part of that. Yeah. It was just fascinating.
That brings up a related question I have. From hearing you, your background and some of what you've done, it appears there are many different sciences and areas of knowledge that help to become a cartographer. But is there any specific thing that you have to do to be called a cartographer?
No, there's not a certificate. And in the GIS world, there's a various efforts towards trying to get that kind of a, you know, something of a certificate, you know.
Right.
You'd say you are a...
But if you're also a surveyor, of course, then you have to be...
Surveyors much more rigid, more like lawyers. But no, to be a cartographer, you know, it's sort of, if you can do it and people pay you to do it, then you're a cartographer.
You have the bona fide is to get the jobs. So.
Yeah, yeah. And so, you know, other than coursework and you know, on, you know, experience somewhere, I think most people who are, well, there's either old school cartographers who are coming to it from history, but the kids that we're producing would be going out, they'd get a job more like a, you know, GIS intern or, you know, technician. And then, you know, if they have the talent and the aptitude for the cartography side of it, that would sort of grow gradually through their career.
So I couldn't call myself a cartographer for making a flour, salt, and water map.
I mean, sure you can.
Yeah, sure, why not?
Curiously enough, on Facebook today, a page came up where they were selling these plaster or whatever maps for whatever state or the moon or whatever you wanted to. And they were melting the map on top of the three-dimensional.
Sure.
The technology was a little more advanced than it used to be.
Well, we did that with the Heritage Museum, where actually I took what was the modern equivalent of the
Kelsplatter,
which is LIDAR data. So satellite, LIDAR, aerial derived imagery and elevation data that then I turned into colors of shades of green and blue, which then somebody draped over a 3D model and made that. It was back at the shop for a little while. Is it, Bruce?
Yeah,
back
in it had started to delaminate on us, so we sent it back to them, and they made us a new one and out of super, you know, laminated sort of stuff. But it's right in the entrance of the museum, and it's fascinating to watch everybody, but particularly kids.
Yeah.
I mean, they just... They're peering over the edge, and there's this sort of model of Vashon Island with the sound, you know, and sort of I think it's a three times.
Yeah,
sort
it's got a vertical exaggeration. The world actually turns out to be really flat.
Pretty flat.
If you do it one to one, it's kind of boring.
Yeah.
So we stretch the vertical dimension both for the bathymetry, which is the below water elevation. Topography and the elevation above.
So this is the Salish Sea map you're talking about?
No, this is a map of Vashon.
Oh, Vashon,
so
okay.
So you can go in and you can sort of feel the ridge lines. You can feel the drumlins where the glacier
And I did
sort of
that over. This weekend because did I couldn't you? Believe that Agron Park was actually higher.
Isn't that amazing?
Than being high on Maury, so to speak.
Well, yeah, right.
Yeah.
Atmospherically high. No.
That's right. Yeah.
You know, technology has changed so much. I mean, when I was in the military, we dealt with aerial photography quite a bit. And one of the things that they developed at that time was if you have the latitude and the time of day, you could measure a shadow and determine the height of the object that was producing that shadow. Well, now I'm sure the LIDAR probably takes away all that effort.
But we used to, you know, same thing with trees. They have the, I forget, it's not an altimeter. It's some gizmo that you could go out there and you sort of how far away from you and what's the angle and you can get the elevation.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Well, it's using trigonometry.
We used to do that in Boy Scouts.
Yeah. I had an incident where I had to replace a flagpole and the lanyard had broken on the flagpole and we had to say, geez, how tall is that darn thing?
Yeah.
And I remembered from trig and I set that darn thing up and measured the angle and we figured out how tall it was.
Or geometry.
Well, right. Trigonometry. It was trigonometry. It wasn't geometry. Well, it was trig because it was
trig. I understand. let me ask another little question about that because you worked on a Salish Sea map, did you not? You developed that. And I'm curious, where is that? What were the major challenges in developing that and the Vashon map? You've already talked a little bit about that, but can you expand on that?
Yeah,
a bit?
I mean, the Salish Sea map. I mean, first of all, you know, Bruce's your intro locating us in the Salish Sea. You know, that's something that you wouldn't have said 20, 30 years ago. And all so right. it's from my standpoint, that's a huge success to hear people referring to themselves as living in the Salish Sea. I had the pleasure, honor to be part of a quick backstory on history of the Salish Sea as a name. A fellow named Bert Weber proposed that back in the 80s. He was a marine biologist concerned about the inland marine waters of Washington and BC, which are an estuary and thus vulnerable. So he thought having a unified name, which there wasn't at that point, would help the environmental protection, management, all that stuff. So he proposed this idea, came up with the name Salish Sea, which was, I think, a lucky choice of names. Nice alliteration, but also had nice tie-in with the tribal communities. And proposed it to the Geographic board names. There are these boards in BC, Washington, US, and Canada, and it got shot down. It did not get the way a geographic naming board works is it's very grassroots. Basically, if people are using that term, then it's a name, and they say, yes, that's an official name. Unlike recent history, it is not usually decreed by any individual. That's an anomaly.
The Gulf of America?
That is not how it usually works. Yeah. Exactly. So anyway, so Bert proposes this name, has this good idea. It doesn't go through, but nor do they completely deny it. They table it, which left it open. And what happened over the years is people started using the term specifically, or especially resource managers, DNR, and tribal First Nations individuals. And so at some point, there was a second effort at that. This is where I came into it. And the second effort was a more formal campaign to actually, let's get this, you know, if what the naming board wants is usage, let's get the name out there. And so by this time, I'm working at Western at the Environmental Studies College, and Bert, who was at that point faculty emeritus, but had been friends with my father. I'd known Bert since I was 10 years old. Yeah. Bert shows up and asks for a map. And what he wants is a map that doesn't have a line through the middle of his estuary, which is the international border. And it turns out it's very hard to find. Borders are big things. And so we put those on most of our maps. And he was having trouble coming up. He just wanted to be able to talk about, you know, so, you know, I just need to show the area that we're talking about here. But I don't want a line right through the middle of my environmental protection area. So I said, sure, I can do that. And then I said, but if we're going to do that, let's make this, you know, as beautiful as possible. And, you know, with the goal of something that somebody might want to put on their wall. In essence, treating this as a piece of propaganda in a good way. You know, every map has a purpose. And so the purpose of this map was to get the name Salish Sea out there. And so I did the best I could, made what, you know, a pretty looking map, as opposed to just a map with, and Bert printed up literally thousands of these, and they went, you know, to schools and museums and government offices and public officials and, you know, anyway, so the name eventually was adopted, and I like to think that that map that I had some small part in that, in those thousands of maps that went out there, and the Coast Salish tribes formally adopted the name in, they were ahead of the curve in like 2007, 2008, and then 2009 and 10, the geographic naming boards of Washington, British Columbia, Canada, United States, all adopted that as a name. And again, it wasn't replacing anything. You know, so it was less controversial, though it still had some pushback.
That's amazing. I thought that was, it had been called that for eons, you know, like we're going back to Mount Tahoma or something.
Yeah, no. And the Salish, it was a fortuitous choice of names because, Tahoma, that would be, which is a mispronunciation, but that would have been a term of one particular tribe. And if you use a name of one particular tribe, you have 30 other tribes that are less happy about that. Right. There's just, you know, and so the term Salish was actually a anthropological, you know, a European term applied to a language group. It goes all east into Montana even, but we're in the Coast Salish region. And so I think that worked out really well. Not only did Salish Sea sound nice, you know, rolls off the tongue, but the fact that it was, is, you know, an obvious tip of the hat to the indigenous peoples without taking a term from a tribe that then would have been had pushback.
Controversy.
It,
yeah.
It was easier accepted by all.
So I had a quick follow-up question with that. So how did you actually define the Salish Sea? I mean, how did you draw that map? I mean, it's really watersheds and sort of international bodies of water.
Yeah, you know, exactly.
Gulf, I mean, Georgia, Puget Sound. You know,
right, and some of it's easy because you got Puget Sound. That's pretty easy. You get, you know, Strait of Juan de Fuca. Well, you sort of pretty much draw a line at the end of there, but it's a little bit debatable. The north end is the more difficult, and so, you know, where you've got Strait of Georgia, and then, you know, what happens at the north end there. And when I came in, and Bert and I defined that as Johnstone Strait, which is where there's a little bit of water that goes through between Vancouver Island and the mainland.
That's right there.
up north to the end of there. Mm-hmm. there's another voice that says, no, the end of the Salish Sea should be further south, a little south into the into that. They're basing it on marine life and, mm-hmm. and where you see a change. And basically some of the northern water of the Salish Sea up into Deception Pass. Up in not Deception Pass.
Desolation Sound.
Desolation Sound, Sound, thank you. The wrong G. Desolation Sound. Some of that water is actually draining out to the north. You know, the all Gulf of Georgia, Strait of Georgia, all that, almost all that drains south and out through Strait of Juan de Fuca, but a little bit goes through north to the Johnstone Strait. And so there's some distinctions that put the boundary kind of where that hydrological break is. Mm-hmm. From a land kind of watershed basis, Johnstone Strait is the narrowest, it's the neck of where you end the sort of inland waters and get to a channel heading north there. Then the other discussion is how far up the hill do you go? And so there's, you know, the map, you know, has drawn with a what we termed a basin boundary, sort of, which is very much like a watershed, but not a watershed. And we carefully didn't use the term watershed because, watershed, you know, what do you do with the mouth of Strait of Juan de Fuca? But more than that is you've got the Fraser River coming through there. And the full watershed of the Salish Sea is this, most of British Columbia. It's huge. And so we chopped that off, and you can't really chop off just the lower part of a river. Watersheds don't work that way. Yeah. So it's more of a bowl, a basin shape, the visual kind of what you could see from the salt water. And you're trying to capture the area that was in, you know, maritime influence and influence, you know, both ways, influence upon the, you know, the cultures.
Fascinating. Yeah. Kevin.
I'm curious, we talked about the Salish Sea map. At least four of us on this call are mariners, boaters of some sort or another. I'm just really curious about the intersection between GIS and maritime charts. And I don't know if there is an intersection there, because you don't have LIDAR, right? Now, yeah, I guess you could for the buoys and the shorelines and so on. But is GIS actually... helping us to improve our maritime charts?
Oh yeah, hugely. And you've got all the you know, in terms of depth sound, you know, the old days, again, we were dropping rocks on strings, but now you've got, you know, sonar and all this trying to get ever better. I redid that Salish Sea map 2023, and one of the big advantages was that in 2009 when I first made it, I just couldn't get very good bathymetry data that underwater. And so and so consequently, the first version of that map, it printed, it looked pretty good at 11 by 17, but if you poster printed it larger, it just, you could just, low resolution. Well, 20 years or 15 years later, I could get much higher, and the big change was not the ground data, but the underwater data, the availability. It's, yeah, I mean, you know, most of the planet is wet, and so there's a ton of research going into marine, you know, everything from fish and currents, but yeah, that down that underwater stuff. And GIS, there's a whole GIS subdivides into, you know, you got planning, you got natural resource management, you've got, you know, nautical charts, aeronautical charts. So there's a whole wing branch that's very much focused on that, and some fascinating work with. You know, as you get that better and better bathymetry, you have the ability to start really modeling currents and current flow and what's going to happen if there's an oil spill or there's a sea level rise or all these variables that keep changing. So the sophistication of those models just keeps getting better and better.
So, you know, like back in the old days, there were different, I think, four different levels of survey data. And certain accuracies, right, that are associated with each marine survey of the bottom of the under the water. Is that still true with sonar, or is that like the technology is like, we're going to get everything at the same level of fidelity, so the survey thing has kind of gone out the door?
Yeah, I'm not familiar with, I don't know, but I think in general it's like LIDAR on the land, we're going for everything we can. There's a cost, and obviously the deeper the water gets, the harder, you know, the more expensive it gets to get good data. So, yeah.
So, all right. Well, you talked about the Vashon map earlier. I don't know if you had anything to add about the challenges of creating the Vashon map, or did you pretty much?
I mean, there again, that was largely a data harvesting. So between King County and USGS and Washington State, a lot of the data is already there. you know, the first map I made of Vashon was for the Strawberry Festival. You know, the year the parade was drove all over the island. So we took the parade to the people rather than the people to the parade. So I get to make a map, you know, that route. So the base data was all I could gather that, and then it's a matter of trying to make it somewhat aesthetically pleasing, and then, you know, drawing a line or so. So all I really added to that was the parade route, and then a similar map. I got hired by the Chamber of Commerce, the Vashon Murray Chamber, to sort of put their businesses on the map. So again, I'm putting my dots or their dots on a map. You know, the work in making a map, ironically, is largely, you know, for at least for me, is the text. You'd think maps are visual and kind of imagery. It's just sort of there. And that's the fun part. And then the work part is getting every word label, you know, for streets and creeks and you know, of course, where people collect, you have a park and a school and a street, and all those text has to be on top of each other. So that was the sort of work of there, the challenge, as it were, is making that all look like it's supposed to. I just recently was looking, I kind of hate to say this on air. I was recently looking at that map I made. I made two or three versions of this map for the chamber. And I was and looking at it, it's like, that street name's not right. That's not, I've got, and it goes back to the King County data. I just took it on faith that King County knew what they were talking about. Mm-hmm. So some of the streets are named avenues, and some of the, you know, the north, south, east, west. It's just wrong. And so then I had to go through the whole map and look at it again. And there's a challenge that the next version. If you're a geographer or a kid out there, you want to, you know, get a hold of the Chamber's map and see if you can circle every air and get it back to me.
So. Boy, this really, really opens my eyes. As you know, I'm a pilot, and I use signal charts, and we don't use WAC charts anymore. But you know, that scale. But so those
we use flammable charts.
Flammable. He's implying that we burned our.
I remember.
Charts. Yeah, and they do work.
It works well, by the way. Better. Yeah,
they're quite flammable. So anyway, and I'm also working with this disaster airlift group that we're trying to put this together. One of the things that we're going to be doing is putting together routes for damage assessment. And so right now, CERT has ground maps that are used for the ground people. I think there are six different routes that they drive to
right.
check all these areas. We're going to make maybe one or two aerial maps that will do the same thing. I may be calling you.
Yeah. I've talked to the CERT folks about at some point getting a cleaned up version of those ground routes.
Yeah. Really use.
Yeah.
I mean, we're going to be using lat long, you know, positions for those, because you'll be plugging them into your GPS in the airplane.
Right.
So you can fly to those places.
Yeah. I would hold up the display an aeronautical chart in my cartography classes as an example of a very difficult map to read, you know, that takes a certain level of spatial literacy. Yeah, you got to be trained how to read that. Yeah.
And good eyesight.
Yeah, they're ugly at first glance or a certain kind of beauty. You know, the thing is, once I have that base map, I've gotten the data from the county, whatever, and I've got cleaned up the street names. What I put on top of that, the operational layers, right. You know, so sure, if you want to give me coordinates for air routes, that's super easy to make
sure.
You know, big blue stripe or whatever color you want, to make that thematic.
Right. Oh,
yeah,
that sounds great.
Sure.
So this is really a dumb question, but so why are maps important?
I mean, and paper maps, especially.
Well, yeah.
Well,
we'll talk about that next.
I mean, maps are important because we're visual. Humans. I mean, and I was joking this morning with Michelle. I was like, "Boy, the radio is the worst place to talk about." You know, usually when I do a talk about maps, you know, I've got either paper maps to hand out or a screen to show this map and look at this, and it's such a visual thing. You know, picture captures 1,000 words, and a maps are even worse. So, I mean, imagine trying to describe the zoning nuances across the county. And the spatial relationships of why this is zoned that versus that, you know, visually it's just super. It's a very efficient
way.
It's easier. And
yeah.
Humans have been making maps at various levels and you know, as long, you know, longer than we know, because they used
inferior archival mediums. But they were drawn, you know, people have been drawn with sticks and mud and whatever. So I think that they're, that it's, and again, there's more maps, you know, as it gets easier now than ever to make a map. We're making more, you know, it's every, you know.
It's like photography. I mean, look at, there's more photographs being taken today than probably all of human history up to, to today.
Yeah. And people said that the computer was going to, you know, we would never have any more printed paper. It's like, no, it's just the opposite. We got printers and now we're printing everything, you know?
So that gets us to this next question then is, are we going to keep having paper maps because of all the digital stuff that's happening?
Yeah, I hope so. I think so. I mean, there's people love maps, and so you're always going to have people. I was just talking to a cartographer the other day. And he said, I should have just gotten into business selling old printed copies of old maps. I would have made more money than as a cartographer. But so people love maps, and but there's also, I mean, I was the kid in the back seat, you know. Mm-hmm. And so I hope those kids are still there. I guess they got their phones now. Mm-hmm. But you're gonna, you know, sooner or later you're gonna lose power. You're gonna lose GPS. You're gonna lose, you know, the internet, and if you're on a boat or in the airplane or in the woods, it sure would be good to have a paper map in your pocket.
My absolute favorite thing, I'm a flight instructor as well, right? And my absolute favorite thing to do is to be flying with a student who has his electronic map and everything, and it's all laid out there. Boy, the course is plotted on. I mean, they're amazing what they do today. And what I usually it's on an iPad or some tablet. And what I usually do will say, gee, let me take a look at that for a minute. And I'll look at it and then I'll throw it in the back seat and say, your battery just died.
What are
you going to do now?
Exactly.
You know, and they go,
Yeah.
But they pull out a chart and they start figuring out where they are using that paper chart.
Schumer, so, I thought your favorite thing was to cut the power.
Well, that too. But it really is an eye-opener when you... I mean, the technology today is so amazing.
Yeah, we don't want to not use that.
Exactly.
But we don't want to be completely dependent.
We don't
want to
be
absolutely
dependent on Kevin. Kevin, you had
definitely the belt and suspenders thing for mountaineering and climbing. You know, nowadays you got lots of Gaia, I think is the name of one of the apps. You see people on the trail and they're following their phone. Yeah. And that's awesome, you know, because it really clarifies things. But like you say, when that battery goes, all of a sudden you need that map and compass skill to really know where you're at. I'm a champion of paper maps as well.
One of my favorite stories about this GPS and the directions, you know, that you get from your phone or your. I rented a car. This is years ago when they were first doing this. I rented a car down in San Diego, where it tells you turn left, turn right, you know, and the next. And it was pretty crude, really. And it would go bong, bong, you know, you messed up, you know, go back. But I spent the weekend in San Diego, and I drove all over heck. I have no idea where I was.
Sure.
None.
Yeah. And there's some great studies like that where, if you give somebody a Google Maps in the car and they drive the same route for a week,
they don't
learn a thing. But if you give them a map... After the second day, they don't need the map anymore. They've learned, they've put it into their memory.
Exactly.
And they know the landmarks. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. I find that interesting. Yeah. Well, and also when you're giving direction to someone, you know, what do you say? Well, you go down to that big spruce tree on the right side and you turn left and you go down to see the church and then, you know, you don't use place name or the...
The street, classic Jesus barn.
Exactly. Yeah. Exactly. Turn left to the Jesus barn. Right, yeah. Right, yeah. Right. Exactly.
Yeah, I can verify that from just the recent trip my wife and I took back to Sioux Falls, South Dakota. She said, I do not want to have this only on our, you know, CarPlay or on her iPad. I want the paper map. So I had to write to AAA or Amazon to get the map. She loves maps. Yeah. I mean, real maps. Yeah. But I find that interesting. My background in college was psychology and cognitive process and that sort of thing. And I remember a study back then that said generally, I hesitate to stereotype, but generally women... tend to do better remembering places from landmarks on land, whereas men are better at 5,000 feet, looking down at a map. But I think you're absolutely right. I mean, there will always be room for maps. Although you run into some people,
young people who swear they've never, ever used a map. And I go, oh, yeah, you should try it sometime. Actually, my question, I think, has been answered there about, you know, what maps can communicate, basically, that other methods can't. I don't know if you can add anything to that.
I think it's just, there's, again, it would be really hard. It is hard to describe. Not that maps are perfect, but, and I would counter that those kids that are saying they've never used a map, they've, yeah, they have, because every real estate ad, every, you know, how to get to the park, you know, the school bus routes, they're inundated. You know, what I found is that when I was teaching at the university level, you know, the level of spatial literacy is so, you know, you cannot grow up right now and not be map literate. They haven't ever had a piece of paper in their hand.
Right, or big folding map
in the back seat, but they definitely know how to navigate a map.
They may not know what north from south.
That's right. Just always state north is up. Stays
exactly.
There.
Yeah.
So, but I, you know, so I mean, I grew up, you know, the kid in the back seat, and I don't think I ever thought I could be a cartographer because I didn't have, you know, the artistic talents of Bruce Mercer or Annie Brule. You know, the computer for me made it possible to start to enter into this field that was, you know, what I didn't have the artistic talent for at some point. So I think there's a whole new avenue for kids to get into mapping that might not have made it too.
I have one more quick story about maps. My wife and daughter and I were in Europe, and the maps we had there were really pretty good, but you know, you can't drive and read a map at the same time. So my daughter was in the back, and I think she was about a sophomore in high school. In fact, she said, give me that map, you know, and she began giving us directions. And one of the problems that I had with it was scale. You would look at something and say, well, that's a block away. Well, it's only about 30 seconds away because it's, you know, much smaller. But she would say, turn right here. And I would go, that can't be right. And she took us everywhere we needed to go. She was great at reading a map.
Yeah.
I was proud of her.
She wasn't very nice in giving you directions.
Well, that's true. Dad, you're stupid. You're oh, no, direct. Sorry. You know, no.
Kevin, you had a question or a comment?
Oh, okay. No, I just been looking studious, I guess.
Well, let me ask, you know, how do you see maps evolving, changing, that kind of thing? No,
you know, everything's changing. You know, AI is coming in, the data gets better, but I don't think it's not fundamentally changed. You know, we're still asking the same questions. You know, the job's still there. We still need the humans to, even if the AI can write the program, I still need a human to interpret the results and make sure that I'm not going to drive purely on, you know.
Right.
So it's changing, but it's,
didn't write.
You know, I think, yeah, it's changing the world, but it's also still the same.
Great.
Yeah.
So if our listeners want to know more about you have a website, you know,
StephanFreeland.com, but you can just search, if you Google, you know, Salish Sea Map, you're going to find mine amongst many now.
Okay.
But mine was one of the first ones.
And your website again is?
StephanFreeland.com, all one word.
Yeah. And how do you spell Stephan Freeland?
That's why Googling Salish Sea Map is easier. StephanFreeland.com, yeah.
So it's well worth visiting his
website. But go to the Heritage Museum as well and check out that both the 3D and there's a map that I was only partly, mostly it's Bruce Mercer's beautiful work, but I helped work on that. Check out the local maps.
So we're down to our sort of last minute here. Just want to thank you, Stephan, for coming in and sharing this with us. Amy is not here to tell us what's coming up next week. But let me tell you what she has arranged. She has scheduled Rachel Hetrick, who manages Island Center Homes for Vashon Household. She'll be our guest next week, and we'll learn about Island Center Homes and some of the work of Vashon Household. So for Truman, Craig, Kevin, Stephan, I'm Bruce Hallman. Thanks for spending an hour with us, and thanks for listening to KVSH 101.9 FM, The Voice of Vashon, also streaming live on voiceofvashon.org.